have a poster on my wall from 1996 from a tour I organized with the late Gary Webb and, oh God, it is so hard to say it, the late Robert Perry. The focus was one of the most troubling and controversial stories of the late 20th century, the CIA's involvement with drug traffickers to help finance the overthrow of the fledgling socialist Sandinista government in Nicaragua. This occurred after Congress cut off aid to Ronald Reagan's so-called freedom fighters because really they were a bunch of terrorists, drug dealers, and mass murderers. The story, which I reported on extensively as well, was toxic for anyone who touched it. Bob nailed it down in Central America in 1985 and 1986, and then Gary Webb picked up the story a decade later at the docks of San Francisco and tracked the Contra cocaine into the heart of South Central L.A.
Good evening and welcome to Giants of Journalism. My name is Dennis Bernstein. I am a producer for the Pacifica Radio Network, KPFA, and an associate editor with the Pacific News Service. Tonight on this special program, we have three guests who have really taken on the establishment, reported the difficult story, and suffered for doing it. We're going to hear about those stories, what the confrontation was about, and what got them in trouble. And I want to welcome our guests here, Robert Perry, Gary Webb, and Pete Bruton. They've all in some way or another, really had confrontations with what I would call the national security state. Robert Perry is the author of several books and now the editor of IF Magazine and the Consortium Internet News. Gary Webb is the author of Dark Alliance, the CIA, the Contras, and the Crack Connection. And Pete Bruton is the author of The Mafia, the CIA, and George Bush. I wonder why that got him in trouble. And I want to thank you for joining us this evening. And let's go around the horn here and find out exactly what the story was that got you in trouble. Bob Perry.
Well, in 1981, Dennis, I was with the Associated Press and put on their special assignment team. And the story that I started working on was the story of the CIA's involvement in Central America, which was a hot issue at the time. The Reagan administration cared a great deal about what was happening in Central America. They were involved in El Salvador, where a right-wing government was in power, in Nicaragua, where they were challenging a left-wing government in power. They were working behind the scenes in Honduras and Guatemala. So there was a great deal of drama to the story. There were massacres occurring against civilian populations. There were CIA secret armies being formed. And that was the story that I began to look at in that period of the early 1980s. Leading eventually to coverage of Oliver North's secret operations, the first stories about Contra drug trafficking, and other aspects of that rather curious and often very violent episode in our history.
Now, I believe you're the first journalist who named Oliver North in public, you and Brian Barger. There was this source in the White House, and nobody was talking about who he was or what he was really doing.
Well, we had a number of sources by the time we were getting to the point of mid-1985, and I did a story in June of 85 about Oliver North. At that time, I had known North. The question was whether he was secretly running the war or not in Nicaragua, because the Congress had forbidden the administration from continuing to support the Contras. And what we were beginning to hear first from Contras and then later from people inside the government was that North had taken over that responsibility. It was a very sensitive story, one that the White House denied rather vigorously and continued to deny, really, for about a year and a half.
What was the date? What was the first story that mentioned the Contra drug connection?
Well, Brian Barger and I did a piece in December of 1985, which was based on reporting we had done in Miami and in Central America. And that story looked at how a number of the Contra units, really across the board, there were different groups, as you remember, certain small armies and factions, but effectively every major faction of the Contra army had gotten involved in drug trafficking. Our focus was at that time in Costa Rica, where there were several units, including the FDN, which had begun an operation in Costa Rica. There were also Cuban Americans who had gone in to Costa Rica, supposedly to help the anti-communist cause, but who were essentially moonlighting as drug traffickers. And we had that picture. We had it from DEA officials from the field. We had it from people back in Washington, and we had it from the Contras themselves. And that's when the story, when the AP ran the first story about that in December of 1985.
December of 1985. Gary Webb, you sort of picked up the story many years later. You were a reporter with the San Jose Mercury News. Mm-hmm. Tell us about how you came to this story that now we know as the Dark Alliance.
Well, actually, one of the first calls I made was to Bob to find out what had happened to the story, because I had gotten a tip that the Contras were dealing drugs in Los Angeles. And this is 95, so it's 10 years, almost 10 years later. And I had, you know, I had followed around Contra fairly closely, and I had remembered whispers or rumors or something about Contra drug trafficking, but I never remembered how I heard it or where I heard it or what became of it. And when I started going down this trail again in 95, I ran across a fellow who worked on a Senate investigation who mentioned the work that Bob and Brian had done back in back a decade before, and called him up and asked him if he had ever heard anything about the Contras dealing drugs on the West Coast, in Los Angeles specifically. And Bob said that they had heard some things about stuff going on the West Coast, but most of their work had been done, as he said, in Costa Rica, and that they really didn't track it once the drugs got into the United States. They were sort of looking at the transshipment points down there involving the Contras and the planes and the airfields and stuff. And so, but it was good to hear that I was, you know, there was a journalist of some repute who has said that this is, you know, this was going on, and it, the story has truth to it. And it was very encouraging to me to hear that, and that's when I told my editors, I said, this is a good story, and we're going to go after it. And ultimately, it led to a series about sort of how the crack market in South Central Los Angeles got started back in the early 1980s, and the interconnection between a crack dealer named Freeway Ricky Ross and a couple of Nicaraguan Contra supporters who were selling cocaine in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and their connections to the CIA, and where some of this money that they were making from selling drugs was going, which was to buy weapons and supplies. And that was essentially the story, and it was interconnected into showing how something that the Central Intelligence Agency was doing in Central America, which was the story Bob was covering, how it was impacting on us here at home through this drug trafficking that was coming back from the Contras, and what happened to this cocaine once it got to the United States.
And what was the initial reaction when you first broke the story?
Well, the initial reaction, and we did a three-part series, and it broke in August of 96, right in the week between the Republican and the Democratic National Convention, when, like, every reporter in the country is on vacation. And so it came out. Nobody saw it. But we had a website.
I can tell you a few of us saw it.
Yeah, well, you were one of the first ones to call me.
It almost fell off our chairs.
You,
here we
you
go
were
again.
The first one to call. Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Better warn this guy.
Well, Bob did warn me. Bob, to his credit, did warn me off the story, and I thought he was like a nervous Nelly or
and
something.
And we're going to hear more about what happened, but so the initial response was?
First of all, silence.
Yeah.
And then it was picked up on the Internet, and it got picked up on talk radio. And once it got the Internet and talk radio started going, then people started finding out about it, and they started calling up the website and reading the story for themselves. And we were, at one point, we got like 1.3 million hits in one day on that website. So the story got out that way. And then the mainstream press had to sort of acknowledge that something was going on.
And in a way, that was sort of revolutionary, because the web became the equalizer. You know, as many people who get the New York Times could see this right here.
Probably more.
Yeah.
Because we were getting email from Denmark, and college students in Sweden were emailing us saying they'd read it from there. So it was really the first major investigative piece sort of to break on the Internet, which is where it broke.
Wow. Now, Pete Bruton, your story broke in a mainstream paper. You were, well, talk a little bit. Give us a thumbnail sketch of the what led to the mafia, the CIA, and George Bush. Give us just a taste of that.
Well, once upon a time, I was a grunt newspaper reporter in Houston, covered courts and county government, city hall for the Chronicle, and I did investigative stories for the Houston Post, medicine, hospitals, nonprofit foundations, local government. A business reporter at the Post got a tip about a failed savings and loan and some kind of questionable connections, and they asked me to help him, and we found, immediately ran into the mafia, involved in a little savings and loan in Houston, mafia from New York. So we did this story for about a year and a half, and it was widely praised and got a lot of attention, won awards. And then I wrote a story that had three little letters in it, CIA, and things changed dramatically.
What changed?
There was either silence or fellow reporters downplaying it or criticizing it. And this was something that was new to me. I couldn't understand why another reporter would criticize this story. And other organizations came out of the woodwork. It's like there's this fifth column of support for the CIA in this country. And anytime something critical comes out, it's like the red flags go over everywhere. And people come out of the woodwork and start criticizing it and getting stories, writing op-ed pieces. It's a whole mechanism that just comes out, and you're the brunt of it. And the Post, to its credit, ran some of these stories. They did not run others that were more important ones. Our law firm, the Post law firm at that time, had killed these stories. And that prompted me to quit the Post and write this book. And that was also just the beginning of my problems.
It apparently prompted you to become a lawyer to know how to hold them accountable.
Well, I decided to go to law school. I just got fed up with lawyers telling me what I could and couldn't print.
Right.
And I've ended up having to support myself to playing lawyer.
You are listening to Giants of Journalism. My name is Dennis Bernstein. I'm hosting a very interesting hour with significant investigative reporters who took the risk, who went after the hard story and felt the heat of what it means to take on the power structure, the political power structure, and what I also consider the national security state. And what I'd like to do is go a little bit deeper into the reactions of all of your stories, because I believe that really you in your reporting, essentially you were brought smack up against really the powers that be, the powers that really control the flow of information and decide what's going to get out there to the public and what's going to stay inside based on so-called reasons of national security. Talk about what was happening behind the scenes. I mean, your story, one of your earlier stories about this stuff was released by mistake, by accident.
Right. Well, the original story on Contra drugs was that case. Barger and I came back from Costa Rica, and we at that point had multiple corroboration of this problem. There were documents. There was even an indictment of one of the Contra leaders. But we came back. Brian thought we were in good shape. Brian was sort of new to the AP. I'd been there a lot longer, and I explained that no, I think the struggle's just begun here. So we got back to Washington, and the initial reaction from the bureau chief was fairly positive. He was well reported, was well presented, and he thought there might not be that much difficulty. But it went to New York, to the top level of the AP, and came back with a lot of concerns. We went back and did more reporting. I went back to a source at the White House, who I still can't name, although he's pretty well known now. And he actually took information from a CIA report where the agency itself had confirmed some elements of the Contra drug problem, although he tried to steer me away from some others. But so we went back again with this more detailed information. The DEA said that they were aware of a lot of drug trafficking in northern Costa Rica, although they wouldn't say officially who was behind it, but it was quite clear that the Contras were. So we ended up with that story, but it still wasn't enough. And finally, I sent in the story to the attention of the bureau chief. And while he was busy being killed by the upper echelon in New York, the story also appeared on the AP's foreign language computer. And so it was just routinely translated from English to Spanish and moved out on the Spanish language wire by editors who didn't know there was a problem.
And that's how the story broke.
And then a couple days later, Brian Barger got a call from someone who'd read our story and called to congratulate him. And Barger was just ashen. He came over to me and said, somehow the story's gotten out. And we traced back and found out what had happened. And then the AP very quickly put it back into English and moved it for the National Wires. But that is how the first story got out about Contra Drugs.
Now, you say they put it back into English. Did they put it into English that people would understand the implications of the story?
Yes, yes. Although there were some things that were left out that I would have liked to have had left in. But we went out, and then the next day, the State Department, at the regular briefing, announced that there was no evidence to support this story. A claim that we now know, based on the material that came out after Gary Webb's piece, that the agency has now released, showing that there was a multitude of evidence supporting this, much more than we ever dreamt of or knew.
Now, at what point did you know that this is going to be trouble for you, that you have gone too far, that this is a story that people do not want to hear about?
Well, we were hearing all the way through this time period of the mid-80s, the attacks on us. It was sometimes direct, sometimes subtle. The main story we were working on was the North Network story, which was also being denied. The White House was claiming there was no North Network. We had made this up. The Congress had done a brief investigation in the summer of 86 by the House Intelligence Committee, which amounted to going over and asking Oliver North if our story was true, and he said it wasn't, and they wrapped up the investigation and called me and said, your story doesn't check out. So we were left not only with the White House and the State Department and the CIA denying our stories, but even the Democrats in Congress were denying our story. And at that point, by the middle of 86, we knew we were in deep trouble. Barger had been put on the overnight desk at the AP, which is not a pleasant experience, and told he'd probably stay there for quite a while. He resigned because he had a daughter he had to take care of who was school-aged. He couldn't go into the school year that way. I was in the doghouse. Clearly, I'd taken the AP off on this wild goose chase, and I'd been there long enough and won awards for them, so they weren't going to do anything, but it wasn't pretty. And that's where we stood, really, going into the fall of 86, until on October 5th of 1986, one of Ollie North's last planes, one of the last planes in his whole operation, was flying, left from El Salvador, flew down the coast, cut across Nicaragua, and some teenage Sandinista draftee, a kid who never had fired a SAM missile, shoulder-fired SAM missile before, saw this plane, took aim, and fired his surface-to-air missile at it, and remarked later he was amazed that it went in the right direction. and the missile struck the plane under the wing. There were the crew members, only one had a parachute, named Eugene Hassenfuss, an American. He was about to kick out some rifles to the Contras, so he was near the door. And as the plane spun out of control, he was able to crawl to the door and push himself free, and he parachuted to safety, although into Sandinista hands. And it was that central accident of history that let the American people finally in on how their government was functioning in a war situation in Central America.
And that man was Hassenfuss.
Eugene Hassenfuss survived. At that point, Barger, Brian was already doing some work for CBS, so he calls me and says he thinks he can get us an interview, AP and CBS combined, that the Sandinistas might set that up. So he and I fly down to Nicaragua. The Sandinistas, being totally inefficient and unsure what to do, did not give us the interview, but they did invite us over to the headquarters of military intelligence. So we sat down with a Colonel Ricardo Wheelock, who was head of military intelligence, and while Barger and he talked in Spanish, they dumped all the records that they had obtained from the plane onto a coffee table. And these were essentially the flight logs maintained by one of the co-pilot who died, Buzz Sawyer. And I spent the next hour or so scribbling into my notebook all these codes, because they're all done in like four-letter airport codes, most of which I did not know. So I just copied them all down, and the plane IDs, the tail numbers. And that's what we basically got out of that trip. We flew back to Washington. I got a book that has all the code numbers of different airports around the world and began to translate what this report showed. And what it showed was that this was a very busy network. They've been flying all over the place. We were able to identify some of the planes.
And some of them were actually flying out of a place called Barranquilla, Colombia.
Well, one of the planes, and this was something I did not understand at the time, but Buzz Sawyer, who was the co-pilot, had flights out of Barranquilla, Colombia, aboard a Southern Air Transport plane. By having the tail numbers, you can also then check with the FAA, and they'll tell you who owned the plane at that time. So we found out that there were these planes flying out of Southern Air by Southern Air Transport out of Barranquilla that Buzz Sawyer was piloting. We put that in the last paragraph of a story I wrote for AP, describing these strange travels of this co-pilot. I got a call from someone from Senator Kerry's staff, Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, who was looking into the drug question, and amazed at this last paragraph. And I didn't, at the time, know what they were interested about it. But it turned out they had a witness named Wanda Palacio, who was a woman who had worked in Colombia with the Medellin cartel and had been with Jorge Ochoa, one of the leaders, on one occasion, and with some other Medellin cartel figures on another case, where they watched planes being loaded with cocaine, and she had identified Buzz Sawyer as one of the pilots, and she said that they were flying out of Barranquilla sometime in early October 1985. And it so happened that the logs that we obtained from the plane matched exactly. They showed three flights by Sawyer on a Southern Air Transport plane into Barranquilla on 3 days in early October of 1985. So it became, that would normally be considered very important corroboration, but as Washington was working, and with the White House and the Reagan administration still denying essentially everything, it never went anywhere. At that time, Bill Weld, who was the Assistant Attorney General for Criminal Affairs, simply discounted Palacio's testimony and threw it out, as they did with most of the testimony that came in that implicated the Contras and the CIA and drug trafficking, which is a routine way of handling it. So that angle never really went anywhere. The American people were still kept in the dark about what the government knew about that aspect of the Medellin cartel's role in working with the Contras and the CIA.
So here you have a member of the North Network flying out of Barranquilla, Colombia, with Ochoa on the dock, with, by the way, Wanda Palacio, who was also used as an FBI informant with some success, and also right. passed, I understand, a lie detector test. Gary Webb, the interesting thing that you brought to this story was Bob and then several of us caught on to the story of the drugs coming in, the essentially Ollie North and others piggybacking Contra operations onto drug trafficking operations. But you were extraordinary, and your story was extraordinary because you sort of nailed the end game. Could you talk about how that thing started to unravel after the initial stories broke and how this started to get ugly for you?
Well, yeah, I sort of had a picture of the end of it at the beginning, but I didn't know how to get there. And what I had was some information that these Contras were dealing cocaine. And when I was looking for the one Contra drug trafficker, I called a lawyer who handled a case a couple of years earlier that involved this fellow. And I said, do you know where he went? Do you know where he might be? I'm trying to track him down. And amazingly enough, she did know where he was going to be, because he was going to be in San Diego, because he was serving as a government witness in a case she was handling as a defense attorney. And so suddenly I had this bit of information that this guy who'd brought 4 tons of cocaine into the country for the Contras was now working for the U.S. government as a government witness. And I thought, well, that's an interesting thread to start pulling on. And I said, what case is he testifying in? And she said, well, have you ever heard of a guy named Freeway Ricky Ross? And again, by coincidence, I had, because I had done a series for the Mercury News a couple of years earlier. I mean, Ricky Ross was the biggest crack wholesaler in Los Angeles, and I had done stories looking at asset forfeitures and wondered why he'd never lost any of his assets when he went to prison. So I knew who he was. I didn't write about him, but I knew who he was. And when she said, yeah, do you know this guy? I said, yeah, he's the biggest crack trafficker in L.A. And she said, well, that's what I hear. He is the fellow who they're trying to send to jail, and this Contra is being used as a witness against him. And I said, how do they know each other? And she said he used to supply him during the 1980s. And that's when it clicked. And you had the Contras who were bringing drugs into the country, now we know, sometimes under the auspices of the CIA, selling it to crack dealers in South Central Los Angeles right at the time the crack market was exploding down there. So the story we traced sort of laid the blame for the emergence of the crack market in South Central L.A. at the feet of this Contra drug network, because they were really the first, they were the first quantity cocaine dealers to go into those areas.
Now, when this story broke, your editors were very with you.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
I know I appeared on panels where they were giving you rave reviews and standing next to you and very proud of the work that you were doing. So how did you know
Well, it's like all three of us. I mean, we had done a lot of good work for the organizations we worked for. We'd won a lot of awards for them. We were very reliable reporters. And you have sort of have to be to kind of do these stories. They're not going to take some kid out of college and say, you know, go out and dig up the secret network at the White House for me. They're going to pick experienced investigative reporters, and we, all three of us, were. So it's not surprising they stood behind us at first. They put them in the newspaper. They approved these stories and edited them and put them in the newspaper. And it was when the other media jumped in. I mean, the CIA naturally said, oh, no, this is nonsense. We never deal drugs. We would never countenance dealing drugs. We do all sorts of things. You know, we kill people and we blow buildings up. We do all sorts of stuff, but we don't deal drugs. Take our word for it. And the media believed them, right? And they said, well, there's no evidence that the CIA knew about these drug traffickers because the CIA said so. And that's the depth of the investigation. But it scared the editors of the Mercury to have other newspapers attacking them. Because there's sort of a gentleman's agreement in the newspaper business that you don't go after somebody that's in the same business as you are.
And you had all three of the big ones going
Yeah, all three of them. And two of them on the same day. Two of them came out with three-part series on the same day.
And were you shocked when your own editor went public against you?
Yeah, because, I mean, he had agreed to put it in the newspaper in the beginning, and as he admitted in his column in which he said he was sorry he ran it, he couldn't find a factual error in it.
Pete Bruton, when did you realize you were going to have a problem trying to write stories about the relationship between the CIA, the Mafia, and George Bush?
Well, as I said, when our law firm started raising questions, but the original ones that ran, the Associated Press picked them all up and put them on their, I guess they call it A-Wire.
That's how I read them. I couldn't believe it.
And a lot of newspapers around the country, the medium-sized ones, ran the AP stories. But the New York Times, Washington Post, L.A. Times, Wall Street Journal, none of them did. In fact, the only stories they ever did on it was when the House Intelligence Committee, that had conducted an alleged investigation prompted by the stories, came out and said there's no evidence that the CIA was involved in any of the SNL looting. And then, and only then, did the New York Times, the L.A. Times, and the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal write stories saying there's no evidence that the CIA was involved. Of course, if you'd just been reading the New York Times and you saw it through, where does this come from? You mean something's been going on with this? You wouldn't know that. All you would know is the House Intelligence Committee found no evidence for it. Of course, the CIA had, that's where they'd gotten their information, had done what they call a limited hangout. They said that of the 17 institutions I'd written about, the failed ones, and the six individuals, five of those individuals were had done work for them and had been associated with them in the past, and four of the institutions they had done business with, but they weren't involved in any of the stuff I'd been writing about.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is a special devoted to the late Robert Perry, who passed away over the weekend, and it features Robert Perry and Gary Webb talking to a story that both of them broke in terms of CIA involvement with drug traffickers to overthrow the Sandinista government. It cost them both dearly. That's what they're talking about. Listen to this.
Understand, and the congressional investigation was conducted by Daniel Childs. You want to tell people who that was?
Daniel Childs had been the chief financial officer of the CIA and had been mentioned in Iran-Contra investigations and had been interviewed twice. I believe had a deposition taken twice in the Iran-Contra investigation. Had come over to the House Intelligence Committee just months before my story came out, and I'd been working on it for 6 months before it came out. So the CIA knew I was working on this story. They knew 4 months before he went over to the House Intelligence Committee. They conducted the investigation, said there was nothing there, and then Dan Childs turns around and goes back to the CIA after their investigation was completed.
I remember I got Dan Childs on the radio live right at the beginning of the congressional investigation, and I asked him on the live show if, in fact, he was the same Dan Childs who was the former comptroller for the Central Intelligence Agency, and there was a long silence, And he said, yes. And I said, well, don't you think there could be at least the appearance of a conflict of interest? And he said, no, that's why they hired me, because they know all about
this. He knows this stuff.
Bob, you went from the Associated Press to Newsweek, and you didn't win any friends over there with these stories, did you?
Well, right. There was a period right after the Iran-Contra scandal finally fully broke when the when it became clear that there was a North Network, that it became clear that there was even the selling of arms to Iran to raise money for the Contras, that the story had sort of got a cachet for a brief period of time, and there was sort of a sense of vindication, I suppose, of, among those of us who have been trying to push it. And during that time, I was approached by Newsweek and offered a job, and my battles with AP had just been sort of difficult for a long time, so I decided to go. And I got to Newsweek in early 87, did the first week I was there, I did a story about how the cover-up of Iran-Contra had really tracked all the way into the Oval Office, and that there had been special efforts to mislead the American people even then about what Ronald Reagan knew, a piece that was controversial and came under a lot of attack from other news outfits, and Newsweek sort of backed away from it, even though it was entirely correct. But then, as this went on, there was, of course, the Tower Commission report, which was the first report on what happened. It was somewhat misleading, but it had some facts. And after that, there was a party. Newsweek used to have these dinner parties, as they still do. But they'd have dinner parties with big newsmakers. And this would be at the bureau chief's home. Evan Thomas would host them. And some of the brass from New York would come down, and there'd be a few of us low-level correspondents who would be allowed to sit there and so forth. And they'd be catered affairs. And the first one I went to was in March of 87. And there were two guests. There was Brent Scowcroft, who was had been one of the Tower Commission members. And there was Dick Cheney, who then was a congressman from Wyoming and was on the Iran-Contra congressional investigation. And this little dinner gets going. And in the middle of it, the Scowcroft seems a bit uncomfortable. And he sort of says, I probably shouldn't say this, but, you know, if I were advising Admiral Poindexter, who was, of course, had been National Security Advisor for Reagan, and if he had told, and if Poindexter had told President Reagan about this diversion of armed profits to the Contras, I would advise him to say that he hadn't. Which struck me as a rather remarkable comment coming from someone who was just supposedly investigating for the truth on what had happened in this whole affair. So I stopped, and without really understanding the etiquette of this affair, I said, General, you're not suggesting that the Admiral should commit perjury, are you? And there was like a stunned silence around the table. And the editor of Newsweek, Maynard Parker, who was sitting to my left, sort of breaks this moment and says in a loud voice, sometimes you have to do what's good for the country. And there was sort of manly guffawing that went on around the table, and it was all sort of understood. And it was sort of my introduction to a different level of how this works. At AP, we're mostly kind of drones. We're kind of hardworking, you know, average kinds of reporters who do pretty good work overall, I think, and honest work, somewhat limited work. But at Newsweek, it was more into the elite realm, where the policymakers and the top editors are really very close. They're friends. They move in the same circles. They're on the Council on Foreign Relations together, and at that level, the editors really stop being journalists and become more policy guiders for the country. And at one point, I was told at Newsweek by one of the other correspondents that our job really is to lead the American people to the right decision. And it was made clear to me that Newsweek saw the Contra operation as a good thing, and was very much on the side of Reagan's efforts in Central America, and we all should be part of that team.
So the journalists become part of the national security state, part of from the fourth of state that's supposed to be watching what's going on, they become the PR firm for the federal government.
Well, I'm not sure they put it quite that way, Dennis, but the thinking was...
Did I overstate the case?
Well, I'm not sure you did, but I'm not sure they'd put it that way. Basically, what they're saying is that that the American people need to be guided to these correct decisions, that the editors, who often really do share the views of the policy elite, and this is bipartisan, too, by the way. It doesn't necessarily happen just for Democrats or Republicans. But in this case, Reagan's foreign policy was embraced by many of the senior executives in the news organizations at AP. Keith Fuller, who was general manager, was very much in support of the policies. and let it be known to the staff that that was the case. And the same at Newsweek. It became clear that they did not want to see the Iran-Contra scandal go too far, that they thought it should be cut short, that they didn't think too many people should be implicated.
And what happened to you when you wouldn't let it go?
Well, they made it clear I wasn't very welcome. It reached the point that even when it got to the stage of Oliver North going on trial, which happens in 89, I was told by the bureau chief, Evan Thomas, that we were not going to cover the trial. That it was not going to be news.
It wasn't news.
It wasn't news. And even Pacifica covered the trial. But Larry Bensky was there. But
Larry's not there now.
But Newsweek wasn't there. And so I was sort of stuck in the situation. I was kind of responsible for the story, which I knew was going to be news, whether they liked it or not. But I also knew that they didn't want me to cover it. And so what happened was I arranged to have the daily transcripts for the trial delivered by messenger to my house, and it would arrive. The guy on a motorcycle would come by at 10 p.m. or so, and I'd read the transcripts that night. And we got some stories out of that, ironically. But Newsweek did not cover the trial in the sense we were never there. And that became clear as we went on that they just did not see this as a story they wanted to put to rest very quickly. They did not want the angles, and I kept trying to push the Contra drug angle, which we were learning more and more about. By 89, we knew that there were other connections to the vice president's office than, of course, Vice President Bush, that his office had been involved in operations involving something called the Armed Supermarket, which was, according to their own records, funded with drug money. And we knew there were serious problems, but whenever we went to those areas, we'd have trouble. And I'd hear things like there was another dinner party that I was not at, but Maynard Parker was there. It was Richard Holbrooke had hosted it. It was at his house. And Donald Gregg, who was the vice president's national security advisor, was there. And one of the people involved in Iran-Contra in a very shady way. Gregg was a former CIA officer. And the next morning, the bureau chief came up to me, Evan Thomas, came up to me and said, boy, you know, Don Gregg spent last night chewing Maynard Parker's ear about you. And your editor, the editor, is really mad. And so it became very clear that this was just not going to be allowed, and reached the point that I was told that whenever my name was mentioned, Maynard Parker would start yelling. He was the editor of Newsweek.
Now, clearly you were touching a nerve because, among other things, Donald Gregg was sort of a liaison between the Contras. He was liaisoning with Felix Rodriguez, who played a key role at Ilopango Airport. Speaking of Ilopango Airport and the bigger story that you got involved with, Gary Webb, you started to get hell. It happened at a lot of levels.
Right.
You know, your own editor turned his back on you. But it happened really at your own paper as well. Your colleagues became nervous.
Well,
they didn't want to be associated with this kind of story.
Well, actually, that was one of the funniest things I ever read. The New York Times did a story about what a bum I was. And they had gone to people in the newsroom and asked them what they thought about this story. And quoted them anonymously, of course, as saying that they were concerned that it would hurt their careers later on when they tried to go to other newspapers to find out, like the New York Times, that they had worked at the San Jose Mercury News and somehow countenanced this outrageous story seeing the light of day. So it was kind of weird. I mean, here you had the editors like clapping you on the back and boasting about their website and going to all these conferences everywhere and talking about what a wonderful dawn of new journalism this was. And then when the political winds changed, they go running for the hills, and they say, well, it's all his fault. And the editor, Jerry Seppos, actually was quoted in Newsweek as saying that he never even read the whole series before it went into the newspaper. Now, to me, if you're going to write a series suggesting the CIA was involved in drug trafficking, you might want to read it before it goes in the paper. He claimed that he hadn't read it.
Now, I've been watching the cover every day from then until now. And we know, as Bob Perry has pointed out and you've pointed out, the Central Intelligence Agency has now admitted it based on its own Inspector General's report. Essentially, they have confirmed the work that you started and the work that you picked up and really expanded. So have you had any interchange with any of these people about the fact that the CIA has now acknowledged that a lot of what was reported was true?
Well,
because I haven't seen it on the covers of the paper.
Well, it was the New York Times did a story.
They did the
they
story.
They did a story.
After they whacked you
the hell out of
there, they did
a
story.
They did a story, an exclusive, that said the CIA is about to admit that it was dealing drugs. So that was, and I think it was last July, that they did that story. And I think you and I were on the radio one time, and the Mercury came out with a story about the identical report saying there was no evidence of CIA involvement.
They found no evidence.
They found no evidence. New York Times did, but they didn't now.
So this was interesting. This was your paper flipping. The New York Times slams the hell out of you.
Right.
They deny that the story exists.
You see what contortions you have to go through when you start trying to weasel out of the truth. You know, it really catches up with you after a while.
Pete Bruton, what was the final straw that led you to say, okay, I've had it with this daily journalism. I'm going the hell out of there and write my own book.
Well, when the Post killed the most important stories I had.
And what was the essence of that story?
It was involving a very rich, powerful Houstonian who had strong connections to the mafia and the CIA.
Would this be Walter Mischa?
It would be.
Now, why were they so nervous about Walter Mischa? Just because he had dinner with George Bush every once in a while?
I think it went a lot deeper than that. Walter Mischa was probably the most powerful man in Texas at that time. And a really indication of his power was that nobody had ever heard of him. Kind of like Carl Lindner before the, you know, Cincinnati stories. And he was a political kingmaker. He was one of LBJ's big backers, John Connally. A lot of people he put into office and pulled the strings on, including both George Bush and Lloyd Benson. And I had connected him to the mafia and the CIA and these people in the savings and loan scandal. And the law firm that represented the Houston Post, Fulbright and Jaworski, Leon Jaworski's old firm.
Oh, we remember him.
Yes. They basically killed the story. They said they would not sign off on these stories about Walter Mischer. Of course, the editors could have told them to go jump, but editors don't work that way. And, you know, because the lawyer said, you do this, you're going to get sued, and you're going to lose, and you're going to lose a lot of money. And so they cratered and decided not to run them. I remember it was like 2 days before New Year's, and I was at my parents' ranch, and I was arguing with the city editor at the time who had pushed the stories, and he said, well, you know, the editor has finally killed them. And I said that the lawyer at Fulbright and Jaworski's job is probably hanging on this. It was, you know, firing these stories. I bet he won't make partner. I was just mad. Anything I could think of. 6 weeks later, after I'd quit, I had lunch with the city editor. He said, guess what? This guy just got made partner. And then I started investigating Fulbright and Jaworski, and I found that they had numerous conflicts of interest. They were representing Walter Mischer's interest in a number of lawsuits, in a number of things. At the same time, they were telling us we could not write stories about him. And furthermore, I found a number of connections between Fulbright and Jaworski and the Central Intelligence Agency, including laundering money for them through the MD Anderson Foundation in Houston.
Now, I think one of the interesting things that I learned from your reporting is the way in which politicians do not bet and power brokers do not bet. They buy the entire Megillah. You know, they don't only support Republicans or Democrats. And your stories sort of showed how, for instance, Lloyd Benson and George Bush were really both equally in the pocket of somebody like Walter Mischer. And I imagine that would bring some attention and problems for a reporter.
Yes. In fact, Lloyd Benson's press secretary, I think his name was DeVore, who later became, when Benson became Treasury Secretary, he became the press spokesman. He blatantly lied to me about Benson's involvement in a savings and loan that had been sold by Benson's family to a very notorious CIA asset named Guillermo Hernandez Cartaya. It was in the Rio Grande Valley. And DeVore assured me that Lloyd Benson had no connection, never had any connection to that savings and loan. And fortunately, I had a document in my hands that showed that he did. I said, well, I've got, you know. And he said the senator was attending some conference in the Canary Islands, couldn't be reached. Well, 30 minutes later, Benson's on the phone to me. Oh, yes, I had interest in that, but I got rid of it a long time ago.
All right, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the implications for this kind of refusal on the part of the big press to go with the tough story. it's always been extremely interesting to me that given the role that Oliver North played in the Iran-Contra affair, given the fact that he literally brought into the State Department drug shell companies, companies directly related to the Medellin cartel and the Colombian cartels, that after convictions and everything we knew, and that he was almost a professed proud liar to Congress, he was able to run for Senate and almost win.
Correct. He almost won in Virginia.
He almost won. So, I mean, the implications are what? That you don't tell the truth, and so whatever criminal actions any particular government employee takes doesn't matter. They just move on because it's national security.
Well, I think the national security blanket covers a lot of things, Dennis. It really is one of the hardest things for the press to deal with. And there's some legitimacy to that. I mean, there are sensitive issues that require secrecy, but often it's abused to cover many others. I think one of the amazing things about how the National Press Corps has dealt with the drug issue, really throughout, I mean, back to 87 or so, the New York Times ran a series essentially saying there was no contra drug trafficking. They ran a series saying that no one had even mentioned contra drug trafficking until after the Iran-Contra scandal broke in November of 86, although AP had run a story that had appeared on the national wires in December of 85, more than a year earlier. So the New York Times was like taking positions that its own simple research would have shown to be wrong. But it was almost determined to knock these stories down, even when it had a lie to the American people. It was a very strange thing. And then we saw after Gary's story came out, the Washington Post did the first big knockdown. And in it, they sort of said, well, there are these guys that Webb mentions, this guy Blandon. And they said, in this remarkable section, they said, but he only smuggled in 5 tons of cocaine. And I never even thought of seeing the words only and 5 tons of cocaine juxtaposed. But the Washington Post did it. And then they said, well, this other guy, Norman Meneses, he may have brought in maybe twice as much or more, maybe only 10 tons or only 20 tons of cocaine. It was rather silly. And of course, what Gary looked at was only one of the conduits. Yeah. The really serious problem here, which the national press has still refused to look at, is that basically a very large portion of the cocaine coming into this country during that period came in connection with the Contra operations from the Bolivians, the Bolivian cocaine coup operatives in 80 to 82, who were involved in supporting the Contras and financing them. Then, of course, the Medellin cartel was involved with the Contras. The Cuban Americans, who were working with the Mafia, they were involved with the Contras, bringing in cocaine out of Costa Rica. Panama, Noriega was recruited by the CIA and by the White House to work with the Contras. You had in Honduras, you had the military there deeply involved in cocaine trafficking, including they tried to assassinate their president based on a load of cocaine they were bringing in to pay for the killers. Ballesteros, who was involved with them, also involved with the killing of Camarena, the DEA agent in Mexico. So the major drug traffickers going on in that period were all connected to the Contras. And in various ways, the Reagan administration had to protect them. It had to shut down investigations. It had to lie in their protection. It had to do everything it could because it couldn't afford, in their view, in this national security view, to embarrass or discredit the Contras. So in some ways, the drug traffickers used the Contras as an umbrella to get their goods into the United States. And I would say it wasn't just the only 5 tons of cocaine or only 10 tons of cocaine. I would say, based on the evidence we have in front of us, it was a large proportion of the cocaine coming into the United States during that time.
It is overwhelming to me. I did spend some time looking at this story over many years, as you know, and I read... you did a great version of the Boisa Rosa story. And it's hard to imagine that they could suppress a story, get away, that Nora... Talk about that. And, I mean, it's unimaginable that the press could let that go.
Well, Bob had mentioned it. They were planning on assassinating the elected president of Honduras, and they were going to finance the assassination with some, $800,000 or $900,000 worth of cocaine that they'd... the FBI had caught in some inland airstrip in Florida, I think. And the general that masterminded this plot was arrested, brought to the United States, and Oliver North and Elliot Abrams, Assistant Secretary of State, and a couple other high-ranking officials from the Defense Intelligence Agency. They all got together in Washington and tried to figure out how to get this guy out of jail so he wouldn't start, as Ollie North put it, singing songs that nobody wants to hear. And the reason we know about this is because Ollie kept writing email messages to John Poindexter.
So there's a serious paper trail.
Yes, there's undeniable paper trail that this happened. And so they got together with people from the FBI and people from the Justice Department to try to figure out how to spring this on Duren General, who the Justice Department had already announced was their prime example of a narco-terrorist, you know.
I believe the FBI had him on camera planning the execution of a foreign head of state, of the president
of Honduras. This was an airtight case. This was an airtight case. They had arms dealers. They had pleaded guilty. They were all going to rat on each other. And eventually they worked out a deal where the general goes to, I think it was Elgin Air Force Base in Florida, sort of a country club, club-fed location for a couple of years. And they, you know, secrete him out of the country afterwards, and everybody forgets about him. And the LA Times, I think, did a story about it, and somebody did a story about it. But it was never anything like, my God, the highest officials in this country are trying to get a drug trafficker out of jail. And this was in the middle of the war on drugs, okay? This was the great part about all of this. This was when Ronnie and George Bush were announcing they were opening each cups and everybody was pure and clean and drugs were the worst evil. Here we were trying to let this major narco-terrorist out of jail and fairly well succeeded.
And the implication of your story being suppressed is?
That we don't want to know this stuff. And I think that was the implication that I saw is that, okay, Gary, that's enough. You know, we don't want to look back at this anymore. This is all behind us now. Now you're saying, okay, this cocaine trafficking went on, and now you're saying it caused the crack explosion in L.A., which in my opinion, it clearly did. What does that mean as a country? What does that mean to us as American citizens? And when you start thinking that your government's involved in drug trafficking, and you've got 18-year-old kids sitting in prison for 30 years for minuscule amounts, and these guys were bringing in plane loads of it and not only getting away with it, getting paid by the government for allowing it to happen. It just sort of turns the whole system of justice in this country on its head, and we're not supposed to think about things like that.
And you confront these power brokers. You confront the national security state. One of your stories, Pete Bruton, got you right to Silverado Bank and one Neil Bush. I imagine people were getting a little bit edgy when you started to get into the Neil Bush connection, what was going on in Silverado, and some connections actually to Contra operations.
Well, people at where I was were not getting nervous. I think that if, you know, Neil Bush, if anything, the Justice Department had done anything or Congress had done anything, a lot of people would have gotten nervous. I think that, it takes really to do something like Watergate or to have a really major cleanup of an institution, you've got to have the Justice Department, Congress, and the media going in the same direction. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. And I think that the people who perpetrated the scandal, SNL scandal, knew that that would never happen. They had enough people compromised in all three of those institutions that it wouldn't happen. But could I go into why does the press avoid the CIA so much? I was talking to Bob about this, and I think I could stand corrected, but I don't think the Pulitzer Prize has ever been awarded for a critical or investigative story on the CIA. I don't think the investigative reporters and editors have ever given an award for investigative reporting on the CIA. In fact, I don't think they've ever, in their 15 years of having this annual meeting every year and 3 days of seminars, 100 seminars every meeting, that they've ever done one on investigating the CIA, the most secretive government organization in this country. And the question is, why? And I think there are a couple of things going on. One is what Bob already mentioned, that the owners and publishers of the major journalistic outlets hobnob with the power brokers of this country, and they love the CIA because they can keep secrets. And they can do things behind people's back. Catherine Graham, the former publisher and owner of the Washington Post, actually made a speech at the CIA one time telling them there's certain things that the public shouldn't know about, certain things that we should keep secret from the public. So you've got that one aristocracy and elite that operates on that level, that the CIA is one of them, and they can do our bidding, and they can hide it. We can hide things from people. And then you've got the journalists who run from the CIA for a number of reasons. One is it smacks of conspiracy theory, and journalists just would rather be called a lying dog than a conspiracy theorist, because then you get pigeonholed with the nuts and the kooks that, you know, think the CIA's beaming reruns of Gilligan Island to them. Journalists cannot stand being made fun of. Okay, that's not. And if you do the CIA, right, you're going to get made fun of. So yeah, you stay away from the CIA because of that conspiracy. And number two, it's very difficult. There are no documents. It's not like doing a HUD scandal where you've got documents out your ears. There's no documents.
Even in this case of the Contras and the CIA, as Gary points out, there were a lot of documents. There were documents surfacing in the early 1980s.
It doesn't matter.
There were documents all over the place. It's not just that there's not a trail. It's that even if you get those documents, you're made to look like an idiot. You're attacked, as Bob and Gary knows. It's pretty deep. Bob, and we were talking about the implications of the press's refusal to get into the national security stories. And it's not just about Contra drugs. That's a very serious story, but there was a bigger story swirling around Central America, and that was U.S. relationship to death squad activities. We now have heard a lot more about what was going on in Guatemala based on the UN Truth Commission. Talk a little bit about that and how the U.S. press missed it.
Right. Well, you know, the Contra drug story did not happen in a vacuum. It wasn't just that the U.S. government decided to hide Contra drugs. The U.S. government in that period had a policy of hiding all the crimes that were being committed by allied forces in Central America. And one of the first ones, and one of the most serious, was the use of death squad activities to silence critics in El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, you name it. These things struck Americans once in a while, although the deaths were just incredible. There were tens of thousands of people being killed, taken out and executed, often tortured. Women were routinely raped. Raping women was part of the process that was taught to these guys who were in these death squads. And the death squads were the government in places like El Salvador and Guatemala. And we saw it the first time in a dramatic way for Americans was when in El Salvador, right after Ronald Reagan's election in 1980, four American churchwomen were kidnapped as they left El Salvador's airport. They were raped and they were executed. They were considered leftist sympathizers of some sort. The U.S. government under Reagan decided that that sort of thing had to be protected, that the American people, if they saw the U.S. involvement with death squad activity of that type, would be revolted and would not go along with it.